Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Back.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Just ahead, we'll hear how Wind River Tribes went to Washington this week to ask to classify a recent shooting there as a hate crime. And a story about Wyoming Grown, a new state program designed to convince Cowboy State expats to move back home.
We have thousands of immediate job openings from our state's top employers.
Wyoming lawmakers are moving forward on a multi-year plan to renovate the state capitol and Hirschler Building.
If we don't do something with this building, and if we don't do it now, we risk losing this National Historic Landmark.
We'll also hear about threats to the grid from solar storms and new research at the University of Wyoming on polar bears, and take a wildflower walk with author Susan Marsh. That's all coming up on Open Spaces on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Back.
And I'm Melody Edwards. On July 18th, two Native American men were shot at an alcohol detox center in Riverton. The man charged with the brutal crime is white. He worked for the city's Parks Department and told police he was on a mission to kill homeless people. But the victims' families and tribal officials say the attack was racially motivated, and they're pushing for the suspect to be charged with a hate crime. As Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports, the shooting threatens to further divide a community where racial tensions run high.
Both of the victims were enrolled members of the Northern Arapaho tribe. 50-year-old James Goggles Jr. once fought for this country in Operation Desert Storm. He's now fighting for his life inside a Casper hospital. 29-year-old Stallone Trosper was killed in the attack. His uncle, George Abeda, says Trosper was trying to beat an alcohol addiction.
Stallone was kind, he was loving, he was witty, he was happy, and he had the respect for his family to take himself to the Center of Hope to detox, get his head on straight, and go back to school. That was the plan, and that right, that freedom, that privilege was taken from him.
According to an arrest affidavit, the shooter entered the Center of Hope Detox Center with a .40 caliber handgun and shot both men in the head while they slept. Riverton Police Chief Mike Broadhead says the alleged shooter, 32-year-old Roy Clyde, then surrendered and confessed, but Clyde claimed the attack was not based on race.
We can only use his own words, but in his words, he was not specifically looking for Native American people. He was looking for people that he described as, you know, homeless, transient people.
The victims' families say neither of the men were homeless. Broadhead says the suspect's avowed resentment of the homeless still raises racial questions.
The racial component of this comes up because a significant portion of our overt homeless problem does appear to be Native American. And so I think that's where people are making that connection.
It's an easy one to make. Clyde told police his goal was to kill those he called park rangers, a slur most say is reserved for homeless natives who loiter in Riverton's public spaces. As a parks worker for more than a decade, Clyde knew these people, and when he chose to target them, Chief Broadhead says Clyde made his first stop at City Park.
This suspect was a parks maintenance worker who cut the grass and, you know, would have to call the police to remove people who were, you know, intoxicated in the park and in his way or, you know, whatever. And that built over time for him. And from his statement, he went to City Park looking for someone to shoot.
On that Saturday, City Park was empty. Today, there's about a dozen people hanging out here, drinking and laughing. Gregory Chavez says the surviving victim is his longtime friend.
Yes, he was my drinking brother. James Goggles, he was so kind and generous, he'd give you his shirt off your back.
Chavez is a self-proclaimed park ranger and a Native American. So is everyone at the park, until a white woman named Dana Flint walks up from across the street. She's a local homeless advocate and also knows Goggles.
He was always a breath of fresh air for us here. Even though he may have been plagued with addiction, he did not. He had a place to go to. But these are his friends that would come to the park, and, you know, most of the time he's coming to check on them.
Flint leads a talking circle for City Park's homeless every Tuesday. She also knows the confessed shooter and can't believe this happened.
Never in a million years. He'd pull over tables for us for our talking circle. He'd be here all the time when we had our talking circle. It's confusing. It doesn't make any sense.
In another corner of the sprawling lawn, A man and woman who don't want to give me their names tell me they frequent the park and the detox center, and they're shaken by the shooting.
Why did you do that to us? Us guys, we ain't got nothing.
We don't have much, and what we do have, you know, we treasure it. We treasure the family, we treasure the people, we treasure our kids, we treasure our elders.
We just barely live, you know?
And we just make do with what we got.
Our tribal members are valuable human beings, and that's what we have to get across.
Richard Brannon is a member of the Northern Arapaho Business Council. The council recently traveled to D.C. to urge the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice to prosecute the attack as a federal hate crime. The feds have agreed to take a hard look. Meanwhile, Brannon says many Native people throughout Fremont County are on edge.
To be honest, I'm fearful. If I was walking in the park when the individual was out hunting human beings, I'm Indian. He may have shot me.
Brannon says the shooting is part of a troubling trend of cruelty and contempt towards Native people in Riverton.
The Northern Arapaho tribe has been treated like a second-class citizen historically in Fremont County in the state of Wyoming and on the Wind River Reservation forever.
Riverton Mayor Lars Baker says city officials would welcome a federal hate crime prosecution. He says while the attack does not reflect the feelings of many in Riverton, he does see more subtle discrimination and stereotyping.
And I think a lot of that is due to ignorance. If we knew more about each other, I think that might change something.
Stallone Trosper's uncle, George Abeda, certainly thinks so. That's why, just days after his nephew's funeral, he's performing with the Eagle Spirit Singers and Dancers for a mostly white crowd at the Lander Museum of the American West.
And there you have it, the women's fancy show.
Our number one purpose is to share a very beautiful culture that is alive and living and thriving in full force today, to break down myths and stereotypes, and to share in a good way with our non-Native brothers and sisters. That's what our performances all are about.
You're going to go back to your families and say you danced with the Indians.
The main thing on Abeda's mind right now is justice for Stallone. He says this hateful action must be called what it is.
So let the truth be told. If it's a duck, let's call it a duck. If that's a hate crime, it was a hate crime. If he was looking for a homeless person, I don't think he looked for large backpacks or shopping carts. He was not looking for the homeless. He was looking for Native.
Abeda hopes his nephew's death forces this community to reflect on the value of all who live here, Native, white, prosperous, or struggling.
We need to make a stand, and we need to let them know that every life is priceless. Every life is valuable. Everyone deserves a right to live life to the fullest.
The man who confessed to taking Stallone's life is charged with first-degree murder and first-degree attempted murder and could face the death penalty. A preliminary hearing is set for August 5th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Turning now to more national news, Cecil the Lion was a favorite and a well-known animal in the Zimbabwe Hwange National Park. Earlier this month, he was killed by an American hunter, and once the internet found out, it wanted justice. Now debate is raging on social media over big game trophy hunting, both illegal and legal. Wyoming doesn't have African lions, but it does have mountain lions, elk, moose, bears, and a good number of big game hunters. Rennie McKay is communications director for Wyoming Game and Fish. He joined Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard to talk a little about how hunting violations are handled in Wyoming and how social media is changing the game.
When something like Cecil's killing happens and there's huge response to it, do you think it could have any impact on how hunting violations or even just hunting itself is viewed within the state of Wyoming?
Yeah, I think that's important to people who hunt fish because by far the vast majority of them are law-abiding. And so when somebody goes out there and tarnishes the image of hunting as a sport and a heritage. People are very upset about it because they want that support for it. They know the importance of the role of hunting and fishing in wildlife management, and they also know the importance of the role of hunting and angling in terms of paying for management of all wildlife and of all fish. So that is something that I think that is a big concern.
I think poaching sometimes sounds, especially on the internet, maybe like a black and white issue. Is there a range of violations?
There are here in Wyoming. So when we're talking about the rules and regulations and laws surrounding hunting and fishing in Wyoming, there are situations where you have people who are cited for shooting from a road, perhaps harvest an animal out of season. Then there's also wanton waste where the meat is left. There can be wanton destruction of animals as well. Those are rare cases. And what happens often, though, is that, you know, if someone perhaps has a permit and they're out hunting and they end up in the wrong part of the state or cross a road into a different hunt area, when they realize that they committed a violation, sometimes they're the ones, and this often happens because the vast majority of hunters are law-abiding, they'll go seek out a game warden and let them know that they committed this violation and turn themselves in and face the consequences because they care about their reputation of hunters and anglers and they want to obey the law.
So how big of a problem is poaching or hunting violations for Wyoming?
We're talking about a tiny fraction of people who engage in those violations that might get lumped in as poaching. But, you know, the most common violation we see in the state is just fishing without a license. You're not getting into those violations that would be called poaching until you get quite far down the list on that. But there are instances where that happens, and that often when we talk to the public about that, the public is outraged, and that's the hunting public as much as it is wildlife enthusiasts.
You're really working with the public to bring in these tips and catch these guys. How big of a component is social media in all of that?
Well, it definitely plays a role. It's what social media has become for everyone, I think, is another way to speak to the public and engage with them. So that happens on a range of wildlife management issues. But then in terms of when we ask the public through traditional media, through in-person conversations and on social media for help in solving a case where there might have been a wildlife violation, we get a lot of interest in that. About on average, the our content on social media, when we talk about issues related to violations, usually gains about 60% more interest than other posts. We also get tips from social media and have solved a couple of cases because of reaching out on social media.
As you engage the public more online, what kinds of effects does that have, maybe on an emotional connection to some of these cases where you're asking for their help?
Well, I think that you know, the digital media is a lot about images. And so as we have that conversation, you know, I think talking about like a moose showing up on the Capitol lawn, that's an immensely popular story. People really do connect with their wildlife and being able to see pictures of it and to have a conversation with the Game and Fish Department or fellow hunters, fellow wildlife enthusiasts. Online and on social media, I think that just helps feed the passion that there is for wildlife in Wyoming.
Why do you think people are so passionate about wildlife in Wyoming?
Well, Wyoming has some of the most diverse wildlife. We have over 800 species of fish and wildlife here. We're unique in that sense. We're famous for Yellowstone, but I think when people come to Yellowstone National Park, it's because they also want to see the wildlife that live in this part of the world. And then the other part of it, too, is, you know, our wildlife is our wildlife, all of ours. It's the public's wildlife. You don't have a privately owned big game in Wyoming. And so I think that creates an attachment and hunting and fishing, I think, is part of that, is people, you know, care about the fact that it is done by most people legally in a regulated manner, that's kind of part of being stewards of the public's wildlife.
Rennie McKay, Communications Director for Wyoming Game and Fish, thank you so much for being here.
Caroline, nice to talk to you today.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard speaking with Wyoming Game and Fish Communications Director Rennie McKay.
When we return, we'll find out about Wyoming's new program to lure its younger generations back into the fold and learn more about the Capitol Renovation Project. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming has long struggled to keep its young people from leaving the state. A post-high school or post-college move to bigger cities in Colorado or elsewhere is so common, it's practically a tradition. But it's not a happy one for state employers who struggle to find skilled young workers. The state's most recent effort to deal with this problem is called Wyoming Grown. It's a job matchmaking program that tries to convince Wyoming expats to move back home. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan reports.
Blake Dollinger is a 33-year-old musician. He lives in Los Angeles, but he grew up in Rawlins, which he says wasn't so bad.
You know, it was obviously a small town, but it was just a really great place to grow up.
The thing is, the music Dollinger is into isn't super big in Rawlins. You're just a second away from
the— It's just much more practical to be in an urban area. You have venues that you can play shows in, cities that you can do small tours in.
As soon as he finished college, Dollinger left for city life in California. He's been there ever since and has no plans to come back. That move is pretty common. Young people who grew up in rural areas move away from home at a rate 3.5 times higher than their city counterparts. Max Salzberg is also a 30-something Wyoming expat. He grew up in Cheyenne, but moved to Fort Collins soon after getting his degree at UW.
I wanted to be able to go to shows. I wanted to be able to go to art museums.
But now Max and his wife, Sonia Salzberg, are thinking about a baby soon and maybe a move. Young people like the Salzbergs are a potential opportunity for Wyoming and other rural states to get back skilled workers. So how do you convince them to give up this? Or this. Well, if you're South Dakota, by getting a little assertive.
Are you looking for a better way of life? One where the skies are blue, the air is fresh, and the opportunities are limitless?
Yeah, that's a robocall. Not usually very persuasive, but this one brings out the big guns.
I'm South Dakota Governor Dennis Dugard, and I invite you to follow your roots back home.
That's a message from the employment matchmaking program Dakota Roots. It was the main inspiration for Wyoming Grown, and it lets moms or high school buddies sign up their lost loved ones to be contacted by a job recruiter who tries to place them back home.
We have thousands of immediate job openings from our state's top employers.
Dakota Roots has had some limited success. It's been around since 2006 and has placed about 4,000 people back in the Mount Rushmore state, roughly 15% of those who have considered the move. Wyoming Grown doesn't have anything as exciting as a robocall, but you do get a letter from the governor.
So here's the text of it.
Haley McKee works for Wyoming's Department of Workforce Services.
Thank you for visiting the Wyoming Grown website and for expressing interest in relocating to Wyoming.
McKee says Wyoming Grown got started after the state ran the numbers and realized 60% of high school graduates left within 10 years. She says, sure, a lot of those young people are not going to give up city life for the open prairie.
But for those people who want to come back who are familiar with Wyoming, I feel pretty confident that we're making some strides here.
So how do you zero in on who actually wants to come back? Here's a hint.
Strategy of trying to attract back people who are in their 30s and had children probably has the best possible chance of success.
Ken Johnson studies rural population change at the University of New Hampshire. He says there is a minor trend, emphasis on the minor, of 30-somethings going back to their rural homes. The ones who do are usually at the point in their lives when they care less about good bars and more about good schools.
Maybe it's not the best job in the world, but maybe it's a good job. And, you know, maybe that's enough to push somebody who is kind of sitting on the fence to think about coming back.
Max Sulzberg's parents are hoping Max will jump off that fence. They encouraged him to sign up for Wyoming Grown, but he insists they're leaving it up to him.
If they hear that I was like, yeah, they're totally pressuring me, my mom would be really mad about that. They'd be like, we are not pressuring you.
Sulzberg says he's still undecided about moving, but
if we had kids and there was a good job and we could move to somewhere in Wyoming where they have decent schools mostly, and I mean, yeah, my childhood was boring. I want that for my child.
Whether his kid will stick around is another question. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Miles Bryan.
The state is trying to spruce up its image in other ways, too. After years of planning, Wyoming is finally going ahead with a multi-year effort to renovate the state capitol building and to completely redo the neighboring Hirschler building. The $300 million project is called a necessity, but concerns about paying for such a project at a time when energy prices are slumping has some worried. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck says monetary issues will be a work in progress as the current focus is on getting the project rolling.
This is about as exciting as it gets right now at the Capitol, as a crew is checking the stone on the outside of the facility. Construction manager Dennis Egge says it's a painstaking process.
The design team has actually looked at every stone on this building. They have taken a forklift and looked at it. These guys are looking at it from a means and methods. What's the best way, budget-wise, to make this work?
Inside, Egge and his crew have cut holes in ceilings, have peeled off paint, and have studied old renovation documents as they try to restore the building to its early 1900s state. The legislature started saving money during the start of the energy boom and voted to spend additional money on the now $300 million project last winter. So why are they doing this? Senator Tony Ross of Cheyenne says the Capitol is falling apart.
The Capitol has no sprinkler system. It has no fire suppression system, has no HVAC. The plumbing is deteriorating. We had a whole leak that was leaking down onto the House floor right before we began our last session. If we don't do something with this building, and if we don't do it now, we risk losing this National Historic Landmark.
Ross says safety is a real concern.
We've done all the analysis of what would happen if there was a fire. Quite frankly, people would die because there's no way to get them out, period.
As the plan to renovate the Capitol was being developed, it occurred to lawmakers that they needed to do something about the adjoining Hirschler building. A good idea in the 70s, it quickly deteriorated and a number of agencies moved out. The agencies that exist there are crammed next to each other with divider after divider separating office space. Construction manager Dennis Egge says it's a mess.
The Hirschler building, someone coming into an agency can be lost for hours, and that's part of what's going to be changing. Make the agency space more accessible, better traffic flow for the pedestrians coming in, walking through the different offices is not going to be a continuous thing anymore. Each agency is going to be more divided up and easier to access.
And they're going to be adding an executive office building to house employees of the top elected officials. Right now, a number of agencies and state employees are spread across Cheyenne. Project managers say that in the long term, this will save the state millions in rent costs. But if you ask legislators about the most important change, the answer is bigger committee rooms. Most rooms can jam in 25 or so people. Ross says that's been a problem for years.
People standing in the halls trying to get in to even have an opportunity to speak. And if they have that opportunity to speak, they don't even know what was said before. So this whole plan is opening up these legislative committee rooms into big public rooms to allow access to, by the public to their government.
Some wonder if the state should be doing this at a time when energy revenue is dropping. Senator Charles Scott tried to remove the renovation funding from the state budget during the last legislative session.
I really wonder if maybe we ought not to put a hold on this thing for a while and think about what we're really doing.
Another senator, fiscal conservative Eli Bebout, was among those who argued for the project. Bebout says an oversight committee will keep spending in check. That committee hired a firm a few weeks ago tasked with keeping the project within the budget. House Minority Leader Mary Throne strongly favors moving forward.
And also, I think it would be good for the economy to do it maybe when we are a little slower. Waiting only makes the cost go up.
By the end of the summer, top elected officials and state agencies will be relocated throughout Cheyenne. And next year, the legislature will hold its session in a large building called the Jonah Business Center. The legislature will be there for 3 years. Senator Ross says it'll be just fine.
It'll be Spartan, but it'll get us through.
Representative Throne says the end result will be worth it.
It'll really be a showpiece for state government.
The renovation is scheduled to be completed in time for the 2019 legislative session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, polar bear research at the University of Wyoming, how the military is developing its own microgrids, and the effects of solar storms. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Polar bears are one of the species that's been hardest hit by climate change. But scientists have long thought that bears might be able to adapt somewhat by effectively hibernating in summer, saving energy during an extended open water season. But new research from the University of Wyoming disproves that hypothesis. Marev Ben-David is a professor of wildlife ecology and one of the authors of the new study. She told Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce that without hibernation, it's an increasingly long and hungry summer for the bears.
Polar bears do most of their feeding in spring, where they hunt seals and seal pups off the surface of the ice. And during spring, they accumulate a lot of resources, fat and protein nutrients that they store in preparation for the summer fast period. When the ice melts and pulls away from the shore, feeding opportunities for polar bears are diminished. They don't get seals. Basically, they go into a fast, and the question we had was, can they adopt special physiological mechanisms that allow them to extend this fast for a longer period now that the summer ice melt period is increasing in length?
Historically, how long would the bears have fasted versus now?
In the Beaufort Sea in the early 2000s, my colleagues estimated that they had to fast for about 100 days. And now it's longer, upwards of 140 days.
And those extra 40 days, how do those affect the bear's survival?
By going into this elongated fast or lengthened fast with fewer resources from spring, the bears enter the winter season in poor body condition. And in the same population we've conducted this study, our colleagues from the USGS recently documented severe population declines and especially in cub survival. Cub survival was especially low.
So you found that polar bears can't hibernate in the summer. Did you find anything else?
Yes. Yeah, so we obviously collected a lot of data, but related to this paper, the most surprising result was actually the declines in body temperature that were that occurred very fast and were to temperatures that were certainly very low for a large mammal like a polar bear. Some bears had body temperatures down to 22 degrees and dropped there within 12 hours. And we realized that they were happening when the bears were swimming in cold waters for an extended period of time. Marine mammals, whales, dolphins, seals, have blubber, which is an excellent insulator. Polar bears do not have that. They have fat, but it's not as good as blubber. So the bears had no insulation to protect their core from cold temperatures. So basically what we found is that the bears shunt blood away from the exterior of the core and create an insulating shell from their own tissues. And so they reduce the gradient between the skin temperature and the water temperature. And that minimizes heat loss while swimming. And that is a really unique adaptation. It hasn't been shown in other mammals. The only other organism we know that does similar things is king penguins.
I'm a little surprised, you know, some of this seems like information that we would maybe already have. Do polar bears hibernate in summer? How do polar bears withstand swimming through cold water without blubber? I mean, those seem like fairly basic questions. Why is it so hard to answer them?
It's really difficult to conduct such research on large mammals, whether they live in Wyoming or they live in the Arctic. Research on large mammals is always difficult. And so in a way, it is surprising that we didn't know all this already, but you'll be surprised how many things we don't know.
So now we know polar bears can't hibernate and that the summer melt season is getting longer. I guess, what is there to be done about it?
The only way we can, in general, ensure that polar bears don't experience severe population declines in much of the range would be to reverse the trend of sea ice loss. Because we know that sea ice loss is tightly linked to climate change, the Arctic has warmed much faster than the rest of our globe. What we need to do is ensure that warming of the Arctic is reversed.
And if we don't, what happens long term to these bears?
The Arctic is a very large area with a lot of variability in the extent of the continental shelf, the dynamics of the currents and the winds. So not all areas in the Arctic are the same. So we still have many populations that are stable. But you can imagine that in the long run, if we have an Arctic that is ice-free, those specialists, ice specialists, will not be able to persist.
Given the future projections for greenhouse gas emissions, sea ice loss, things like that, does it feel like you're, in addition to studying, documenting a species that we may not have the chance to study in the future?
Yes, in a way. My colleague Steve Amstrup, who was the lead scientist for the USGS until he retired, and now works, he's a chief scientist for Polar Bear International, said several years ago that he feels that we may become, from polar bear researchers, we may become polar bear historians. And that really made me think very hard about how much everything we learn about them is important, but also how much we need to do to make sure that doesn't happen.
Thank you very much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
That was University of Wyoming ecologist Merav Ben-David speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce. Federal regulators are working on new rules that are supposed to protect the electric grid from a threat you've probably never considered: solar storms. If you've ever seen the Northern Lights, you've seen the most visible evidence of this kind of storm. They can be powerful enough to wreak havoc on our electric grid 93 million miles away. Inside Energy's Emily Guerin reports that new protections may not go far enough.
A major solar storm sends bursts of electrically charged particles racing towards Earth. When they hit the Earth's magnetic field, they cause beautiful auroras, like the ones these national park rangers stumbled upon last month in North Dakota. They posted this video on Facebook.
It looks like a green fire. It's absolutely amazing.
Last month's aurora was so strong, you could see it as far south as Boulder, Colorado, where at the Federal Space Weather Prediction Center, they're trying to forecast those very storms.
What we have here is a high-resolution image of the sun.
Lead forecaster Bob Rutledge is standing in a dark room full of computer screens, each with a different image of the sun. When forecasters see the beginning of a solar storm, they have to wait 15 hours or so to know how bad it is. That's how long it takes that burst of charged particles to reach a satellite that's about a million miles from Earth.
Kind of like our hurricane buoy 50 miles off the coast of Miami.
These space forecasters communicate with grid engineers like Bill Timmons.
And we basically get alerted when the storms are coming our way.
Timmons does maintenance engineering for Western Area Power Administration. When his grid operators get the alert from Boulder, they pull out their brand new solar storm operating procedures. He says what they do next depends on the intensity of the storm.
It's the same thing as a watch, warning, or an alert on like a hurricane or a tornado. We had the same thing with solar storms.
They're worried about the storm causing a spike in electrical currents that can destroy transformers. That's the part of the grid that steps down high voltage electricity. In a really bad storm, grid operators can cut power to protect transformers. Timmons says they've never had to do that.
We've had several decades of storm activity. There's no evidence of any damage to our transformers or our grid.
But the modern grid hasn't yet experienced a truly massive solar storm, like the so-called Carrington event in 1859. Storm-induced electric current shocked telegraph operators and lit their papers on fire. Researchers say if something like that were to happen today, enough transformers could be damaged to cause 130 million Americans to lose power. And because transformers are so expensive and slow to build, the power could be out for months or even years.
That's just an unacceptable outcome.
George Baker is an emeritus professor of applied science at James Madison University and a grid watchdog.
If we're very serious about hardening the grid, really the only low-risk way to do it is to install blocking devices.
They'd provide physical protection for transformers. Baker and many others say they would work much better than the current solar storm operating procedures that utilities are required to have. Yet there's only one installed in the U.S., and under proposed new regulations, they won't be required for most U.S. power companies. Engineer Bill Timmons says he's not sure they're needed.
I think operationally we can manage this risk. I would hate to overreact to something that may not impact our grid.
There's a fine line between overreacting and preventing the failure of our most important piece of infrastructure.
We lose our capability to communicate. We lose potable water supply. We lose
wastewater. Scott McBride works on grid security at Idaho National Laboratory. He says in a large solar storm blackout,
the socioeconomic impacts cascade and it becomes very devastating.
Learning about solar storms, I could see why some people spend all their time stockpiling food, fuel, and medicine. But grid watchdog George Baker says there are better ways to prepare.
If we were to put our energies rather into lobbying our representatives to protect the grid, I think that's a much better solution.
In the meantime, the Department of Energy is so concerned that it's considering a plan to stockpile transformers and parts in the event of a major solar storm. For Inside Energy, I'm Emily Guerin.
Major power outages have doubled every 5 years since 2000. That's according to research from our Inside Energy team. Electric reliability is even a concern in the places often thought of as most secure, our military bases. Dan Boyce tells us the military has been experimenting with small, independent electricity systems as a way to increase reliability in the name of national security.
Ready for a ride? Here we go.
Raymond Crockett is a supply specialist at Fort Carson Army Base.
You can basically consider us kind of like a Home Depot or Ace Hardware for the post.
The base is very much like a small town with houses and schools, businesses, and Crockett spends much of his day in a white delivery truck hauling stuff here and there.
Here's your parts.
All right, sir. You have a good day.
But when Crockett shows up and when he leaves, it sounds like this. Pretty silent.
Yeah, it's nice. All the guys say I sneak up on them.
That's because his truck is one of a small fleet of electric vehicles driving around Fort Carson. Trucks carrying everything from refrigerated goods to weapons to troops heading out to train. They're part of a project named with a clever government acronym, SPIDERS.
Smart Power Infrastructure Demonstration for Energy Reliability and Security.
That's Bill Waugaman. He leads energy security for U.S. Northern Command, the military's homeland defense arm. SPIDERS is an experiment in electricity fortification. See, Fort Carson is hooked up to the same grid we all use. It's a good system, yet we all know it's not 100% reliable. And Waugaman says some parts of the base need that perfect reliability.
It's okay if the barracks are dark. Now you're camping, right? But you got to keep the data center alive. You got to keep the headquarters command post alive and some other assets alive.
In an emergency, SPIDERS allows Fort Carson to run on its own power generated on site, from a field full of solar panels, from diesel generators, and yeah, from the electric trucks. The trucks, like the one Crockett drives, can plug in and act as storage batteries for the electricity generated on base. That system can power those few key buildings until the main power comes back on. Microgrids like this are not new. They're often powering hospitals, universities, and research facilities, as well as military bases. Usually, though, these microgrids rely on diesel generators alone. During Superstorm Sandy, diesel shortages racked the East Coast. Here's a Department of Defense news clip from the time.
Residents of hard-hit areas in New York and New Jersey have been suffering through major gas shortages.
Generators failed in several hospitals from overuse. Renewables and batteries could make these microgrids more reliable. The military is an important testing ground for making sure these systems work through staging mock cyber attacks on base.
We train how we fight, and so we're practicing as if we're in World War III and the grid is down because it's a bad day in the United States.
That testing and refining of these systems by the armed forces can help drive markets in the private sector. Some entrepreneurs are trying to get ahead of that game.
So we're heading north out of the Fort Collins, Loveland, Greeley area.
Craig Harrison works in real estate, and out in an empty square mile of northern Colorado pasture, he has a vision, the Niobrara Energy Park.
The world's largest planned microgrid.
It may seem like we're out in the middle of nowhere.
Yet you're in the middle of everywhere when it comes to the infrastructure.
Harrison's site sits at the intersection of transmission lines, natural gas pipelines, and one of the largest fiber optic hubs in the country. He wants to pool those resources, combine them with renewables on site, then court the big guys, the Googles or the Apples, to come in and build.
For mission critical items like data centers.
He hopes to convince them his microgrid could be cheaper than the backup generators they normally rely on. Looking at the cost of data centers and the space he has, he thinks the project could be worth $10 billion. Who knows? But according to industry experts, he is on the cutting edge. The market for microgrids is expected to nearly triple by 2020. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues.
We will wrap up our program today with a walk in the woods with author Susan Marsh. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. For women, it's never been easy breaking into male-dominated fields. That was the case for Susan Marsh. She's the author of a new book called A Hunger for High Country. It's a memoir about how her childhood love for nature led her to become a landscape architect for the U.S. Forest Service. Marsh is now retired and writing a natural history of Jackson's Cache Creek. We took a walk, and Marsh talked to me about her years of struggle during a time when the Forest Service hired very few women.
So along here we have Oregon grape, bluebells, more. These are little rock crests that the hummingbirds particularly like. Oh, here's a favorite. This one is leopard lily. It doesn't look like much from the top. It's all green, but then when you turn it upside down, it has...
Well, I grew up in the 1950s and early 60s near Seattle, Washington, and right behind my parents' house was a pretty extensive woodland area, and so that was my backyard, my playground, and I climbed trees and I made forts and I did all the stuff that kids do. When I was nine, I came home from school one day and I saw there were pretty tall trees and I could see the trees were kind of swinging around and I'm going, oh gosh, an earthquake. And the ground isn't moving, but the trees are. And then I saw the bulldozer. And I did watch the bulldozer tearing apart the blackberry patch that my mom and I used to pick berries in, and my climbing trees and all this stuff. And, you know, a nine-year-old doesn't really get what's going on. And nobody bothered to tell me anything that was going on. And I was just hysterical. And I started waving my arms and shrieking. I went out after the workday was over and surveyed what was left, and I had a little pocket knife, and I was going to carve into this Madrona tree. Don't cut the woods down, you know, as if someone was ever going to see this. I realized how futile that was in some way. And I think that's what attracted me to going to work in conservation and also going to work for the public lands. I think the thing that turned me to geology was a professor I had who happened to be a young woman at a time when I think she was the only female faculty member. And it wasn't that as much as just her enthusiasm for her subject. She would wave her arms and talk about how beautiful the place was, and there's this great outcrop up the road and we have to go see it, you know. And I thought, boy, somebody who can get this excited about some sandstone, I thought there must be something more to this. So I did major in geology. Oh, and this one is one of my favorites. It's called meadow rue, and the leaves look kind of like a columbine, but look at these little, these are male flowers, and the anthers hang down, and they kind of remind me of little Japanese lanterns or something. My colleagues who graduated with me in geology almost all went to work for mining companies. And a lot of them would write back to me from places like Alaska and say, you know, I really have mixed feelings about this because I'm out here prospecting for some kind of mineral that's going to end up, if they find it, you know, ruining the place. And it's so beautiful. And I love what I'm doing, but what's the result of what I'm doing? And I thought, I really don't want to do that. I got to find something else. Toward the end of my undergraduate time, I met the man who is now my husband, and his sister worked for the Forest Service. She was paid to go hiking, basically, and I thought, this is the job for me. So I went to graduate school and got a degree in landscape architecture, and it, you know, I think that is what really got me into the Forest Service. And so I started my first Forest Service job in November of 1980. And a lot of the people I worked with liked to joke around and they treated me as a colleague, and it was fine. But there were a few that just, I think they got, they felt like I shouldn't be there because I was female, or it was even more subtle than that. Everybody would stand up and go to lunch and I'd be sitting there, you know, nobody'd say, hey, come on. And so I kind of got used to that, and I was already somewhat used to it because of I went into fields of study that were also mostly men. And after 2 years, I was ready to move on. So I started applying for jobs, and the one that I got was in Bozeman, Montana. That was in 1982. One of the first people I met when I got to the Gallatin National Forest was the hydrologist, and who I always considered a nice guy. And the first question he asked me was, are you a bra burner? And I'm going, what? What kind of a question is that? I finally figured out, you know, I was so flat-chested from the time I was, you know, in my teens. It's like I haven't known a bra since I was 14, and I didn't need it then. Then the problem became, okay, I was female and so were several other people who were also very interested in conservation. They didn't rubber stamp every timber sale that came along. And so a lot of us kind of got blackballed, and some of that was top management. I didn't see anything getting better. In fact, things were getting worse for me. A new forest supervisor came along and had a very us-them attitude about Forest Service employees versus environmentalists. And he saw me as disloyal. And I thought, okay, I gotta get out of here. Their circumstances made it possible for me to come to Jackson. Basically, I was recommended by one of those environmentalists, and instead of saying, oh, it's the enemy, he was saying, well, we want somebody like that. When I first got to this forest, I was the only person on the management team who was female. And several of the district rangers got out of their chairs to shake my hand, and I just about fell over. There was one woman who was chief for a short time. Women in regional forester positions are not uncommon anymore, and we have, in this forest and region, we have women both at our local forest and in the regional office. So, you know, that's changed. There's a lot of high-status women in the Forest Service now. Oh, that's called prairie smoke, and that's for the seeds that make these little feathery structures that look like smoke when you have a whole bunch. It's really important to stay with the mission. because I think the mission is such a worthy one. Clean water, clean air, healthy forests, products, yes, but also places for people to get away from even a small town like Jackson with all the noise and the commotion, to come out here on a trail and listen to the water and the birds. I mean, that is such a gift. And this one is called Sugar Bowls. And another common name for it is Grandma's Nightcap, because it kind of looks like, you know, an old nightcap. But that's another favorite early flower.
That was Susan Marsh, author of A Hunger for High Country, talking about the struggles of her career as a woman in the Forest Service.
Thanks again for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed the program, you can hear it again in individual segments on our website at located at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just simply click on Open Spaces.
You can also comment on our stories and send us ideas for future shows. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page. You can follow all of our reporters on Twitter. And again, we love good ideas and topics for future programs. You can send them to us through our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.